Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my coat.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Ruth Wise, prominent Jewish woman of letters, and now the English translator of the great Chaim Grada Yiddish work, My Quarrel with Hirsch Rosener. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The long run of Jewish fall festivals has finally concluded with the celebration of Simchat Torah last week. We've now entered the Jewish holiday-free season that lasts all the way up to Hanukkah. There's even a special month for the month that begins this coming week, Cheshvan, the single month in the entire Jewish calendar that has no holidays. It's called Mar Cheshvan, literally the bitter month of Cheshvan. But if you happen to be in the professional Jewish business, there's actually something rather refreshing about the conclusion of this month-long overload of holiday happenings. After a nonstop flow of festivals, celebrations, fasts, and feasts, it's a relief, a machaya, to get back to something akin to regular life. Now, don't get me wrong. I love the Jewish holiday season, and each autumn festival has its own meaning and beauty, while each explores an important aspect of ritual and communal life. Every single holiday, from Slichot through Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, from Sukkot to Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah, has something unique to teach us about how to live life well and meaningfully. But while this is an exhilarating period filled with festivities and people, it's also an exhausting time with many additional demands and requirements for a rabbi or cantor or both like me. And that means when we finally settle down to just regular Shabbat once a week, we can really appreciate the virtues of a day of rest and joy that only comes once every 7 days, instead of what can seem, in the holidays of Tishrei, like 3 or 4 times a week. In my own congregation, Beit Simcha, this past week on Simchat Torah, we even dedicated a new Torah. It was a fabulous celebration, touching, meaningful, and great fun besides, but I'm a little tired. I guess at some point you really can get too much even of a good thing. However, it is not truly possible to get too much Shabbat, in my opinion. The Sabbath comes each week to remind us that whatever else happens in our lives, we can, should, and need to take a full day to focus on something other than work or our daily routine. And that day can become a time of holiness, peace, and spirituality, if we do it well. Which means we have to take a little extra effort to make Friday night and Saturday special. Bake challah beforehand, for example. Make a delicious dinner. Put on a white tablecloth on the dining room table. Fill a kiddush cup, light candles. Attend or just log on to a Shabbat service. Make your own Friday night and your Saturday a day of rest, family, music, and joy. And so to play us in this morning, here's a Lecha Dodi, one of my favorite ones, in the Moroccan Sephardi style by Chazan Aaron Ben Susan, the prayer that welcomes the bride Shabbat.
Lecha Dodi, Likra.
Thank you.
That was Lecha Dodi, the song of welcome for the Sabbath bride by cantor Aaron Ben Susan for Shabbat. Coming this Friday night and Saturday, and every Friday night and Saturday, at my own congregation Beit Simcha, in person or on Facebook, or any synagogue near you. Our guest this morning, the distinguished professor Ruth Weiss, has published a new translation of Chaim Grada's great Yiddish novella, My Quarrel with Hirsch Rosener. It's a powerful and meaningful story, and not a Holocaust story, she says, and well, you'll hear much more about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome back to Too Jewish our distinguished woman of letters. You don't hear that phrase enough, but you should. Ruth Weiss is an academic, was the Martin Peretz Professor of Yiddish Literature and Professor of Comparative Literature at Harvard University, a tremendous scholar of Yiddish literature, of Jewish history, of Jewish letters in general, and Jewish culture. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you very much. Very glad to be back with you.
So when I was in rabbinical school, I was nudged by another classmate to go watch this movie, The Quarrel, which I was unfamiliar with the story. It was a lovely film, and it laid out kind of everything you ever wanted to argue about over the Holocaust. I was entranced by it. Tell us how you came to know the story of The Quarrel and about Chaim Grada, its author, maybe in greater depth.
Getting to know Chaim Grada on the page and getting to know him in person were two very different things. I had always heard of Chaim Grada because my own parents are from Vilna. So writers from Vilna and that vicinity were the ones that my parents always spoke about. And they had his books in the house, and it was just familiar to me as a kind of a literary figure that one should know about. And then I went to study Yiddish literature formally at Columbia University, and there I happened to go to a reading, not just a reading, a really phenomenally good lecture by Chaim Grada. And afterwards, I was invited to go with him and his publisher for a drink. And that was a marvelous evening. And at that time, I got to know him a little bit. And so when he wanted to have his work translated, he came to me and asked if I would translate a work called Der Brunnen, The Well. And that was the first work of translation that I undertook in Yiddish. So that's how my relationship with Chaim Grada began. And then, of course, I began reading him on my own. And one of the most well-known of his works was this story, My Quarrel with Hirsch Rosener. So I read it. I was fascinated by it, as everyone who reads it is. And then I taught it several times, and now I undertook this translation and this this new edition that has just been put out by Koren, I think it's called the Toby Press of Koren, and by the Tikva Fund.
I read a story, I think, about you going to dinner with Chaim Grada at the Russian Tea Room.
That's right.
So there's obviously more to this, but we will talk much more about the reason for a new translation of my quarrel. Can we just call it the quarrel, or do we have to call it my quarrel with Hirsch? I always screw up the last name. Russainer?
Russainer, yes.
Russainer, okay.
No, by all means, let's call it the quarrel. Just to be sure that we are distinguishing the text from the movie that, as you said, was made of it.
Of course, it's a fine movie, but it's not the same thing. We will talk much more with our wonderful guest this morning, Ruth Weiss, and we continue in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a wonderful array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675 for more information about Beit Simcha. Our religious school is going for school-age children or grandchildren. Join us for our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's synagogue's on the north side of town. Join us for services, classes, and events. They're open to everyone. Come in person Friday night or Saturday morning. You can email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. The Facebook page is BeitSimcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. Our musical services are in person and by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those through the website, Beit Simcha Tucson. Our wonderful religious school is in blended format too, some students live and some attending on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to attend services, our religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses live and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing and most energetic and wonderfully warm Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona, and its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TOOJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, is very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in North America. According to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean, and now on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments are most helpful. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we were talking last week about your visit to the northwest of Italy, the area that was originally Savoy, and some of the interesting synagogues, which no doubt it would have been great to visit, but really difficult to do so once the Jews have left, even if the institutions, at least the physical structure, still remain. This is not a new problem in Jewish history. Jews have moved from one place to another many, many times over the course of the centuries and left behind beautiful buildings, synagogues, other Jewish institutions, mikvaot, and so on. It's complicated what happens to those buildings afterwards, isn't it?
Very complicated, and the case varies tremendously from one country to the next. You know, recently I was in France, and in the south of France, there are some synagogues which are still in use, but can be toured if you join a group and make reservations online, et cetera, et cetera. There are others which are purely museums, but maintained by the state and staffed with guides and gift shops and all the normal paraphernalia that you'd expect. But in other countries, like throughout the Balkans, for example, and especially in poorer countries, as you go further east, like Ukraine, there were great Jewish communities that had large synagogues that fell into disrepair. And the question of whether they're rehabilitated, restored, turned into museums in places where there are no longer enough Jews to make them function. I mean, there might be three Jews left, or there might be none. That depends largely on government policy and on luck. Some Jewish communities, especially in Eastern Europe, are lucky enough to have descendants in the diaspora who donate lots of money and hire people to keep them up and turn them into living, visitable institutions. And in some cases, particularly in Western Europe, the state, the government, finds it worthwhile to maintain synagogues, at least in some localities, in some regions. There's sort of eminent domain. So the synagogues are no longer owned by the Jewish communities, which are in any case extinct, but they are, in many cases, either through private largesse or through government sensitivity to their role in the Holocaust or whatever. I mean, it may be a way of somehow expiating their guilt feelings. But they do not only keep them open, but maintain them and beautify them and give them a fresh paint job every 5 years and whatever.
There are amazing Jewish museums now in a lot of these former places, former synagogues mostly, or community centers of some kind, but mostly synagogues. There are also ones that have, you know, been turned into churches or mosques or schools or all kinds of other things. It's fascinating because you really want, as a Jew visiting these places, to connect to the Jewish history, but it's a challenge.
Sometimes it's a challenge just to get in. You can find the building, but you can't get in.
Yeah, because there's nobody there taking care of it.
In other cases, there's somebody taking care of it, but there's highly restricted access. Like the Sarajevo Haggadah is the treasure of, it's the Mona Lisa of Sarajevo. And
yeah.
It's in the National Library, in the National Museum, whatever, in a special vault. But it's only visitable Tuesdays and Thursdays from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Now, you know, if you don't know that in advance, the chances that you're going to be there at that particular moment are virtually zero.
Right.
So a lot of times it behooves you to do research or to ask a local guide. You know, I'm a person who never hires guides. But for these remnants of the Jewish past, it's worth consulting with a local guide.
Tom, thanks so much. We will continue to explore the Jewish world with Tom Price and encourage people to listen to your own podcast when we talk next week.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This one for this week's Torah portion of Noah. When the flood receded, Noah reached land. He threw open the doors of the ark and said, "Go forth and multiply." All the animals cleared out, except a pair of confused-looking snakes. "Didn't you hear me?" said Noah, annoyed. "Go forth and multiply." "We can't," replied one of the snakes. "We're adders." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. So much for math jokes. And now a word of Torah. This coming week in Temple, we read the great Torah portion of Noah about the most famous sailor in all history, a guy who rode out the storm to end all storms in an ark. From a forgotten Broadway show on the theme of Noah called 2x2, which starred the late Danny Kaye, it's all about what happens when you finally get off the ark. Here's a great song called When It Dries.
Why are you so gloomy? We're alive and we're afloat. After 40 days and nights, it's shipshape on the boat. Look, the sun's come out again and turned a rosy red. How can you be gloomy when you think of what's ahead? It's gonna be some terrific place when it dries, when it dries. You're gonna see wide and open space when it dries, when it dries. It's gonna be some terrific place. You're gonna see wide and open space. We're gonna have such a human race when it dries. The greenery's gonna have a shine when it dries,
when it dries.
The world'll be full and fat and fine when it dries,
when it dries.
The greenery's gonna have a shine. The world'll be full and fat and fine.
The best thing of all, it's one third fine when it dries.
Grateful to survive, we'll all live side by side in peace, caring for the animals and watching them increase.
Isn't it a miracle? A brand new world begins.
Think of all the fun we'll have
inventing brand new sins.
We're going to walk a righteous path when it dries. When it dries. Remembering how when it dries, we're going to walk a righteous path, remembering how he vents his wrath.
That when he got mad, we took some bath.
When it dries.
The song When It Dries from the old musical 2x2, music by one of the most successful of all Broadway composers, Richard Rodgers. It was based on a play by Clifford Odets. Of course, Richard Rogers was Jewish. Clifford Odets was Jewish. Richard Rogers' most famous partners were the Jewish Lawrence Hart and the descended from but not raised as a Jew Oscar Hammerstein. And, of course, Danny Kaye, who sang that, was Jewish. And Noah, not so much. Judaism hadn't been invented yet. In any case, the great tale of Noah is shared, to one degree or another, by other ancient books of lore and legend, most notably the Sumerian Epic of Gilgamesh, another guy who had to build a big boat to save humanity. But rather than read to you an ancient Akkadian, which was tempting and all, I rather thought David Steinberg, the comedian's version of the moral of the Noah story, would sound better on radio.
Noah! Noah had three sons. Shem, Ham, and Japheth, all three of whom had an IQ totaling 17. The Bible states explicitly that Noah was a righteous man in his generation. The Bible does not add words. Why do they say in his generation? Because we find out later on in Genesis that Noah liked to drink. He was in fact a drunk. The Bible states it clearly later on. Clifford Odets backs it up. My contention is this. If you had to live on a boat with 10,000 mating hippopotami, and those three sons for conversation,
there's just something inherently comic about being stuck on a big boat with a large number of animals. After the Garden of Eden story and the Exodus tale of the crossing of the sea, I suspect Noah might be the single best-known biblical text of all. It's probably the combination of all those animals and the rainbow. With those two symbols, you get everyone from preschool kids to college co-ed dorm rooms. And once you toss in that dove of peace, you have another oft-used universal symbol. Tons of marketing opportunities for manufacturers of toy animals and rainbow-colored bedding. But like so many biblical tales, there's more to this story than meets the eye. It begins, after all, with people doing great evil. It ends with more people doing more evil, in spite of the flood and the ark and the dove and the rainbow. The real message of Noah is that we need something beyond mere symbols or leaps of faith to motivate us to be decent, good human beings. We need the structure of justice and morality that the Torah ultimately provides. Civilization means that we all follow basic standards of conduct in the service of creating a world in which we can live, without bringing destruction on ourselves, on others, or on our own world. That we have the responsibility to protect one another, especially to protect this marvelous planet we have been gifted by God, and to preserve its vitality and health for future generations. In these troubling times, may we all learn to live to these great standards. When we return on To Jewish, our guest this morning, the distinguished scholar and author Ruth Weiss, tells us why it was essential to have a new translation of a great Yiddish work, The Quarrel. Find out why when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
My, the anti-Semites had full sway the last few weeks, now didn't they? Especially the mentally ill anti-Semites. But maybe I'm just redundant here. First, Kanye West sent out a particularly weird and nasty tweet urging people to essentially kill Jews. That followed after West was interviewed by that debased toady Tucker Carlson, and asserted the ancient lies that Jews never create anything and are solely focused on money. Kanye then claimed that he couldn't be anti-Semitic because he is black, and black people are Jews, or something like that. Kanye West may have had huge success in the entertainment field, but he is certifiably insane. that doesn't forgive this kind of vile rhetoric, especially from someone with a social media following of some 30 million people. It's just creepy and awful. Whether or not Kanye West is mentally ill, there's no question he is a bigot, the Jewish Friends actor David Schwimmer wrote in an Instagram post that went viral. His hate speech calls for violence against Jews. There were many more such comments, all of which I suspect will have little influence on Mr. West. And then Donald Trump sent out a message telling the American Jewish community to get its act together and support Israel before it's too late. Since something like 90% of American Jews support Israel and say it's very important to them, what Trump means is that American Jews should support Trump, of course. For Trump, it's always about Trump. But his wording echoed so many anti-Semitic tropes used over the years about dual loyalty, about the untrustworthiness of Jews, and of course his shape up before it's too late is flat out horrifying, coming from someone who has his own deranged anti-Semitic acolytes. Yet another dog whistle to those of his followers who are full-on Jew haters. Can't trust those Jews, they don't even support their own, and so on. Okay, Trump's not as bad as Kanye, who supports Trump. But boy, that's a low bar. And lest we forget the previous 2 weeks' anti-Semitic insanities, the Los Angeles City Council controversy over three anti-Black and anti-Semitic council members has seen the council president resign and two other council members get stripped of all their meaningful committee responsibilities. Man, anti-Semitism is the oldest surviving racism and the most pernicious, and somehow it just continues to rear its ugly head in so many different areas. I haven't even gotten to the Berkeley Law School affiliate organization's anti-Zionism training, which teaches Israel has no right to exist. I mean, those Jews can't have their own country. And which, of course, excludes all Jews at Berkeley Law School who support Israel, which is the vast majority of Jews in America, and frankly, at Berkeley. And in other unedifying news, Australia's new left-leaning government is reversing the decision made nearly 4 years ago to move the country's embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Then Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, a Tory, announced back in December 2018 Australia would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That move put him in line back then with then U.S. President Donald Trump, who had made a similar announcement a year before. The U.S. already, of course, had opened an embassy in Jerusalem, but it made Prime Minister Morrison of Australia an outlier among the majority of world leaders who have long held that whether Jerusalem is Israel's capital should be negotiated as part of an Israeli-Palestinian peace accord. Australia's embassy never actually moved from Tel Aviv, and now Morrison's successor is returning the country's official position to the one it maintained until 2018. Australia is committed to a two-state solution in which Israel and a future Palestinian state coexist in peace and security within internationally recognized borders, said Penny Wong, Australia's Minister for Foreign Affairs, last week. We will not support an approach that undermines this prospect. No word on if Australia is going to open up an Aboriginal state in Northwest Territories. This Australian move drew criticism from Israeli leaders, concerned that it could augur recognition of Palestine as a state by the Labour government of Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, which was formed in May after elections that ended a decade of Conservative governments. In light of the way in which the decision was made in Australia as a hasty response to an incorrect report in the media, we can only hope that the Australian government manages other matters more seriously and professionally, Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid said, referring to the fact that Wong's announcement followed reports that Australian government websites had been updated to reverse Morrison's commitment. Lapid added, "Jerusalem is the eternal and united capital of Israel, and nothing will ever change that." Australia's move might influence Britain, whose, well, now former Prime Minister Liz Truss just resigned. When she was still officially Prime Minister, I don't know, I guess she's still there till somebody else comes in. But anyway, she faced pressure, Truss did, to reverse her campaign trail promise to reconsider the location of England's embassy in Israel and move it from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. British Jewish leaders wanted England to make the move, but an array of influential figures, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, say a move before a peace agreement would be premature. Frankly, the British Conservative Tory Party has much bigger problems these days than this. In the U.S., President Joe Biden reversed or altered many of Trump's other decisions, but he has certainly not done so to the location of the U.S. Embassy in Israel, now in Jerusalem. In February 2021, just after Biden was inaugurated, the Senate voted overwhelmingly to invest in the Jerusalem Embassy, signaling the placement would be long-term. Jerusalem's status as Israel's capital is a consensus issue for Israeli Jews who otherwise disagree vehemently about, well, everything. Jerusalem and its holy sites, including the Kotel and the Temple Mount, carry immense symbolism for Israeli Jews. But remember, all of the capital buildings in Israel are in West Jerusalem, which has always been Israel. In any case, a Brookings Institution's poll about the U.S. Embassy move back in 2018 found that 93% of Israeli Jews supported it. Man, 93% of Israelis don't support anything. Frankly, they are right. Jerusalem has been Israel's capital since 1948. Every part of the national government's buildings, the Knesset, Supreme Court, Prime Minister's residence, the President's residence, so on, are located on land that has always been Israel and is recognized internationally as such. This insane insistence that Israel's capital of 75 years is not its capital, that somehow having your embassy in the actual location of Israel's legal capital city, located on land within the so-called Green Line and part of the state from the time the UN voted to make it so, all of this is nonsense. In happier Jewish news, a very unexpected ball player has continued a fine run of Jewish performances in the playoffs, following Jock Peterson last year, Alex Bregman in previous years, and so on. Only this time, it's Harrison Bader, center fielder for the Yankees, who will play for Team Israel in the World Baseball Classic next year. Improbably, Harrison Bader, known primarily for his defense, has homered in nearly every Yankees playoff game, substantially outslugging Aaron Judge, who hit 62 homers during the regular season, while Bader hit, five. And Bader has only hit 52 home runs in his whole seven-year career. Well, small sample size, so go the baseball playoffs. In any case, mazel tov to Harrison Bader. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our distinguished guest. Ruth Weiss is one of the most prominent women of Jewish letters, maybe the great expert on Yiddish today, certainly one of them. Her new translation of an incredible Chaim Grada story, The Quarrel, has been reissued. Tell us why it's a good time to do that. What brought you back to this story?
I have never really stopped engaging with the story, and I taught it not just when I was teaching at Harvard, but more recently when I've been teaching at Tikva. And it's such an important document in modern Jewish culture that I wanted to make it accessible, which it has not been. It's available to anybody who wants to find it in an ancient issue of commentary or in the anthology of a treasury of Yiddish stories. But it isn't, you know, it wasn't available. So it was time for a new edition. Now, there was no way that I was going to prepare a new edition on the basis of the previous translations, because Milton Himmelfarb's original translation, while excellent, is abridged. And so no one would want to publish at this point an abridged version of the story, although the abridgment itself is very interesting. That isn't the work that one wanted to present to the contemporary English reader. And then another translation that had been undertaken in order to complete the parts that Himmelfarb had not translated is also in a way based on the other translation. And to my mind, it was also in its own way incomplete. So I just decided that I would have to do it all over again.
And so you did. You know, the story itself is fascinating because it plays up all of the, I think almost all of the powerful themes of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, and what being a survivor is. But, you know, since I've been studying and teaching Musar the last few years, I began to understand aspects of the story I never really understood before. Can you tell us a little bit about Musar, that tradition, and how that influenced Grada, and how it plays itself out in the story?
Yeah. Well, at this point, you might be able to do this job better than I, but I became fascinated by Musar through this story. I must tell you that at the time, I knew nothing about it, and this goes back many years, and so when trying to find out about Musar, I started looking up, for example, the Encyclopedia Judaica. Well, guess what? The article on Musar in the Judaica Encyclopedia referred me to Chaim Grada. So I was not much farther ahead. But Musar was a movement that was begun by Rabbi Israel Salanter in the 19th century. A very important movement because Salanter's perception was that while boys were being trained in Talmud, and they were being trained in Talmud because of Talmud's ethical teachings, it did not really develop an ethical personality. So he undertook to create a yeshiva atmosphere that would really develop in the boys what he thought was a much more sensitive, morally sensitive individual. In his hands, it might have been quite wonderful, but over time and under the subsequent leaders of the yeshiva, it became quite punitive. And the yeshiva that Chaim Grada then described, the Musar yeshiva in which he studied, was extremely punitive as he felt it. In other words, it tried to control the ego. It tried to control the urges that young men had, even before they came to the point of expressing themselves in sinfulness. So, for example, in his long poem about Musar called the Musarnikis, a wonderful poem that he wrote in the 1930s, not long after he had left the yeshiva. He describes a scene in which the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, insults him or criticizes him publicly because he's carrying a comb in his pocket. Now, a comb, you see, this was a sign that he...
Vanity.
Yes, of vanity, exactly. And Chaim Grada writes this poem as a way of explaining why he felt obliged to leave this yeshiva. And in that work, he gives quite a negative image and picture and depiction of its teachings. In this work, in the quarrel
yeah,
with Hershva Thainer, it's quite different. Because at this point, I think he creates this work so that he should give Hershva Thainer, who stayed in the yeshiva and then became a Rosh Yeshiva himself, he wrote it in order to give that other voice as much of a hearing as it could possibly have. So here is Chaim Grada, who left Musar. Now,
and left Orthodoxy, we should add. I mean, left observance in that same way.
Yes, that exactly. He left not only the yeshiva, but he left Orthodox observance. Although what that means in a first-generation person is quite different from what we may think. He leaves it, but, you know, much of its teaching, of course, remains powerfully in him. But in any case, in this work, what he does is exactly the opposite of what he did in that first poem. Here, he wants to give the personality and the intellectual voice of the person who stayed Orthodox every opportunity to express itself as it's at its very, very highest level of intelligence and wisdom.
I've just fascinated. I think it's a very fair story in the versions that I've read, in terms of treating both of its protagonists with sympathy. And as you said, a fair hearing for something that he had rejected, but understood that for some people it was salvation. I never want to argue with a Holocaust survivor. And so, because nobody who has not been through that experience sort of has a leg to stand on, right? I mean, it's too much. But this story is so beautifully wrought, and it expresses the both sides in such an interesting way. I can't think of a comparable text. Are there others?
Not quite. Not even in Gade's own work. Because all the subsequent works that he wrote, really quite wonderful novels, they are sympathetic treatments of course, the Orthodox life in Europe, in Eastern Europe, before the war. Almost all that Grada wrote afterwards was about the world that was exterminated. And he felt that it was his duty and his privilege to write works that brought that whole community and all its thinking to life. Now, in some of those books, there are always engagements between the person who is a very firm interpreter of the law and those who are more lenient. Right, so that's usually the tension in these works.
Sure.
Between the person who is, a strict interpreter of the law, and then a more lenient interpreter of the law, or we would say between the liberal and the conservative personality. But you're quite right. In there's no work that is intellectually, philosophically, theologically pitched the way this particular work is. If I may, though, I would like to clarify one point in relation to your emphasis on this as a Holocaust work or a work that grapples with the Holocaust. You see, my reading of it after many, many readings is a little different. He starts this particular story back in the 1930s. When these two men had been friends, and after the Chaim Vilner, the Grada personality here, has just left the yeshiva. So that's when he starts it. And they start quarreling right back then in 1937. And then again, they meet and they quarrel even more ferociously in 1939. And then we skip the war years. And they meet up again in Paris, both of them miraculously having survived. Vilner or Chaim surviving by having fled into the Soviet Union, and Rasener more miraculously having survived in the concentration camps. So they meet after all these years. Now the movie does what we might imagine they would be like. You know, if you could imagine these two people having thought that the other had been killed, suddenly seeing the other person, what do you think they would talk about? Well, it seems to me that under sort of normal circumstances, they would talk about their families. They would reminisce a little bit about the yeshiva. They would certainly want to know what each of them went through during those years. But the most remarkable thing about this work is that none of that is here. They don't talk about their families. They don't talk about the past. Because I think the point here is that the Holocaust, as we call it, or the Churban, as it is called in Yiddish, or the Shoah, is not the most important thing at all. What is most striking is that neither of them has really changed except to become a little bit more of what they were before, and perhaps a little bit more tolerant of the other. So far from being a Holocaust work, I think this is an anti-Holocaust work.
That's a fascinating idea. It's sort of an affirmation of the relationship and the humanity of both of them.
Absolutely. But more than that, it's also an affirmation of the fact that this quarrel that we're talking about between the person of faith and the person who calls himself modern or worldly and cannot live by the commandments any longer, that this quarrel began before the war and that it is still with us. And that in a sense, what the war did, it intensified each of the two sides. It gave them more material to argue with, if you like, but it did not change the fact that we're still involved in the same quarrel. And that's the tension that exists in modern Jewish life. You see what they say to one another is very similar. The Chaim Grade character, Chaim Vilner, says, after what we've been through, how can you still believe in God? But Hershra Seiner has an even stronger retort. He says, after what we've been through, how can you still believe in man? How can you still believe in that enlightened idea that liberal, well-meaning people are going to pursue justice? Huh? And he goes through the arguments to show how you cannot believe that the way to live is to follow the laws of the Torah. That's what can make you a decent person, and that's what can create a decent society. So you see, in a way, they have exactly the same arguments that they would have had before, but now they used their experience as proof that they were right to begin with.
I want to thank Ruth Weiss for a fantastic visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and to get the new translation of The Quarrel with Hershra Seiner?
Well, I will spare you finding out more about me. That's not the important part at this point. but although I must say I have just published a memoir called Free as a Jew. Ah. But that's not what we're here to discuss.
No, but maybe next time we'll talk about that.
Okay. But my quarrel with Hershra Seiner is available. You can find it through the usual outlets.
Of course.
Through Amazon. You can just look it up on the website under Tikva.
It's just a fantastic story.
I really do hope that people read it.
Thank you for bringing it and bringing Chaim Grade to people's attention again.
Well, thanks for the opportunity of speaking about it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Yair Rosenberg, creator and editor of the Deep Shtetl newsletter for The Atlantic Magazine, prominent journalist and musician. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, for information about how to participate and join our wonderful congregation. Our playout this morning is an old-timey classic from the Jubilaires, just for this week's Torah portion of Noah. It's called, well, Noah. My friends of a Shavua Tov, a healthy week, a good week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Noah, my God's said he would ride on the wind and tide.
Children, stop, steal, and listen to me. God walked down to the bandit sea. He declared that he was a sinful man. And then he decided to restore the land. He spoke to Noah.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.